Good morning, everybody. We're back, and with me today as my guest is Abigail Williams, who is a trial attorney, actually very accomplished trial attorney, who is also a nurse. And when we left off, we were talking about decubitus ulcers, and we were talking about the decision-making and determining, as an attorney, what you would do in terms of taking on a decubitus ulcer case. And Abigail, what goes into your decision-making is to determine whether that's what you want to do?
We look into all decubitus ulcer cases because in nursing homes especially, where there is a decubitus ulcer or pressure sore, there are other markers of failure to appropriately monitor and treat a patient, like not being concerned about nutrition and hydration, which leads to pressure ulcers. I would look at how the patient came into the facility, hospital or nursing home. And again, as I said, one of the advantages I have is I can read a medical record like anybody's business, having written in them for so many years. And look at the care that they got, what happened when the area of skin pressure breakdown was recognized, and then what followed therefrom in terms of treatment, and was there any healing? Now, you know, a lot of people will say, well, people get elderly and they have friable skin and they don't have the best circulation. And that may be true if you're talking about a heel ulcer or a toe ulcer. But when you're talking about the coccyx, everybody gets reasonable blood flow to their hips and to their lower back. And so that's sort of not something I take into account. I just say, look, is it here? How did it get there? And could it have been prevented?
And I guess my question is, we all know the elderly do have poor circulation, everything else. Doesn't that actually heighten the nurse's obligation to be diligent in terms of making sure that a pressure ulcer doesn't develop?
Well, I have to say, and here's my nurse's hat on this, just let me be crystal clear. I think that a nurse's obligation to a patient is sacrosanct. They are at the patient's bedside every day. They are absolutely responsible for overseeing that the patient care gets performed, that the patients are well cared for, that they are clean, that they are calm, that they are well tended, and it's well documented. And that is the province of the nurse. That's her job.
Okay. Now, another area in nursing negligence, if you will, is the prevention of falls. And could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. That's a little more difficult. Falls with a significant injury are another never event. Whether they happen in a hospital or a nursing home, you're not supposed to have a fall with a major injury. So when you get a fall, you need to look at the care plan. Was the patient supposed to be ambulated? With how many people? Did they get out of bed on their own? What safety measures were in place to prevent that or alert someone to the fact that they were getting out of bed? And then what flowed therefrom and how significant is the injury? Now, anyone who has a young child knows, no matter how careful you are, you can be right behind your child doing all the right things, yet they can still fall. And of course, they always fall and hit their chin on the corner of a coffee table. And you get stitches and the mom feels guilty for the next 80 years. It's the same with patients. There are some falls that just aren't preventable. You're right there. You have your hands on the patient and they go to ground. Those aren't the kind of falls I'm concerned about. The kind of falls I'm concerned about where a patient was unattended or required an assist of two and was taken out with an assist of one, where it could have been prevented with appropriate oversight and care.
And what are the various preventative measures that are available to the nursing staff to prevent falls?
Well, there are alarms that will let you know when a patient is trying to get up. We don't like to restrain patients. We don't like to restrain anybody. It's not good for the patient at all. But there are two kinds of alarms that are frequently used. One is called a tab alarm. One end is clipped to the patient's gown and one end is clipped to the bed sheet. So when the patient sits up, the tab alarm breaks apart and it makes this just god-awful screeching sound that you can hear everywhere. As soon as you hear that, you immediately respond to the patient's room, hopefully before they've gotten out of bed and hurt themselves. There are also pressure mat alarms, so if the patient tries to get up off the bed, you have an alarm. So those are things where, although they don't prevent the fall in and of themselves, they alert the staff to come running to get the patient.
And are there other preventive measures that can be taken to prevent falls?
Sure. When a patient is up out of bed, you make sure that you're right with them, that the appropriate number of staff are in place to help safely guide the patient from bed to wherever they need to go.
Now, another area that nurses are responsible for are instrument checks. And could you tell us about, and basically these are situations in a surgical setting. How does that work?
Well, during a surgical setting, when instruments are laid out, they are counted, and so are certain sponges. And a lot now, the gauze pads and sponges have a radiopaque strip in it. So in case you think you've lost one, you can x-ray the patient and try to find it. So count's done at the beginning of the procedure. Count's done again at the end of a procedure before closure, and then again at the end of closure. If the count is, and it's double verified, so if the count is off, the first concern is, did I leave this inside the patient? And there's that type of investigation. And the second is, where's my missing piece of whatever? So usually when the count is off, x-ray will be brought in to see if they can see something in the patient. Frequently, nothing's left in the patient. It's a needle stuck under a gauze pad or something. But that's something that's absolutely required before a patient leaves the operating room.
And in terms of the operating room, another area of negligence is actually what they call wrong site surgery. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. So wrong site surgery is another one of those never events where you know you're supposed to operate on the right arm, and yet you do the surgery on the left arm. How that happens is really a very complicated and well-studied factor. Some of it's as simple as flipping around an x-ray, not being able to read the right or the left, the patient getting confused, someone like me who has to look at my hands to tell you if I'm going left or right. And so a lot of measures have been instituted. One thing is called a timeout. But a time to just double, is this the right patient, the right procedure on the right body part? But the timeout is a little piece of a whole bigger sort of universal checklist, things that we go through when the patient, before the patient goes to the OR, when the patient's in the OR. And timeout is that last taking a step back and checking one more time. Are we doing the right procedure on the right patient on the right side? Now, people get very anxious about wrong site surgery. And there's been a lot of litigation over things that, in my mind, are very minor. So they make a small incision on the right arm. Really, they mean they catch it, put in some stitches, and then they operate on the left arm. Should never have happened. But when you sort of think about, in the great scheme of things, has the patient been injured? Not really. So it's one of those things you have to really look at carefully.
And, you know, as trial lawyers, and you know, Abigail, you've done a lot of trials. I've done a lot of trials. The nature of the injury is important in terms of whether or not, as an attorney, you end up taking the case. So if you have a small injury, even though there was definitely negligence, it just may not be something that would be compensable under the law. In terms of the timeout, I mean, we always think of timeouts in context of our kids, but how does it work in a surgical suite? What happens with a timeout? What do they do?
Well, just so that you're clear, it's not just in the surgical suite. It could be in the emergency department before any invasive procedure. They take a step back and say, is this the right patient? Do I have the right equipment? Did the patient consent to the surgery or procedure I'm about to do? Have we made the environment as safe as we possibly can? And am I then intervening in the appropriate manner? And that's a group decision. It's sort of a team decision, not just an individual surgeon position. Now, that comes from pilots in the aviation industry and the cockpit resource management, where there's a final pre-flight check. And the timeout is that final pre-flight check.
And so basically what we're talking about is just maximizing the ability to never really have a wrong site surgery.
Correct. But in theory, that's what it's supposed to do.
Have you handled any cases relating to wrong side surgery where that didn't happen?
I have. And what's interesting is, and again, this gets back to all the pieces you have to put together as a trial attorney, the cases where I've seen wrong site surgery, if you take that checklist, it is correct all the way down. And there's some lapse somehow where nobody catches the right-left distinction. Now, as I said, thank God, most of the time, there's not a significant injury. Should it have happened? Absolutely not. Should it be reported to the Department of Public Health? Absolutely it should, because they need to monitor these things and continuously look for ways to improve care, to improve those checklists, to figure out those lapses. But, yeah.
And when we get back and when we return, we're going to be talking about the Department of Public Health and its role in terms of patient care and in enforcing patient health. And that will happen when we get back in approximately a few minutes. Thank you.